everyone, welcome to The Great American Bash. My name is Brandon Weatherby. The Great American Bash is a podcast about the intersections of presidential politics and professional wrestling. Co-host and co-author Chris Kelly and I are experts in the field, considering that we're the authors of the book, The Donald, How Trump Turned Presidential Politics into Pro Wrestling. You could find that and pieces that we've written for places like The Washington Post and Slate, Vice, U.S. News and World Reports, and more at presidentwrestler.com. To listen to the newest episode of The Great American Bash, follow us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/GabPod, G-A-B-P-O-D. This episode features a chat with 538's Julie Azari. Julie's also a political science professor at Marquette University. It was recorded on July 27th, 2017. Here's episode 52 of The Great American Bash.
You smell what Barack has cooked.
I'm here to challenge you to a match.
When it comes to standing up for the American people, I am ready to rumble.
I think that we may need a wrestler in the White House.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Great American Bash. My name is Brandon Weatherby.
My name is Chris Kelly.
We are sitting in Washington, D.C., home of the Trump International Hotel and current home of Universal Champion Donald J. Trump.
This is a podcast about the intersections of presidential politics and pro wrestling. And we wrote a book about that topic called The Donald, How Trump Turned
Presidential Politics
into Pro Wrestling. I try to say that. The alliteration seemed cute at the time and not less cute every time I have to say it.
We qualify to do this show and write that book because, in addition to doing the research, we've also written for places like the Washington Post and Slate and Roll Call and U.S. News and World Report, and that's where you find your college listings.
And they wouldn't lie to you, would they?
They would never lie to you. We usually don't mention the end of the show interview until the end of the show, but I just want to point out that at the end of the show, I have a 20-minute discussion with Julie Azari. She writes for 538. She's also a doctorate professor of political science at Marquette. But the reason why I had her on the show is because she wrote a piece for 538 called Why Russia Revelations Never Seem to Change Anything. And I absolutely love this article. And it makes it even more impressive that Nate Silver, the guy that runs 538, does not agree with the premise of the article. So he wrote about that. And Nate Silver appeared on one of our first shows when he did not agree with the premise of our book and our entire life that wrestling doesn't matter.
So 0-2, Nate Silver. It's Thursday, July 27, about 8:15 in the morning, so things are going to happen today. We'll get to that. It's day 189 of the Donald's U.S. championship reign.
It's still Universal.
I took the Universal belt off him. I put him on the U.S. title. It's
still because it means more?
Yes, it means more.
The A belt?
On the A show. So the big show.
Well, it's a big show.
Continues to be the healthcare fight.
Yes. The reason why the timestamp in this show is so important is because today is the Votorama Day.
Yes.
Which means that, so the Senate reconvenes by the time you hear the show, which is at 10 a.m. Then they get to debate and blah, blah, blah. And then any senator could introduce whatever and blah, blah, blah. And they're going to vote. Yeah. So that's very, very confusing, and we've shed no actual light on anything.
Because they haven't shed any light on anything, because people still don't know what the bill is that they're voting for. They voted to debate the bill that they don't know what is there. That was a big thing earlier this week when John McCain, who is recovering from cancer surgery and treatment, came back just in time to vote yes to proceed with this bill so that he could introduce Americans to The Undertaker. Much like he wanted to do with Osama bin Laden in 2008.
America can win the war against terror. I'm going to introduce Osama bin Laden to the Undertaker.
We still don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it's moving forward, so we could have no health care or we could have health care. Who knows?
Based on the Washington Post reporting, the most likely thing to happen is a skinny bill.
The skinny repeal.
The skinny repeal, which would not please hardcore people on the right. Clearly, no one on the left is going to vote. No Democrat's going to vote for this. But it might have enough to get the 50 votes. But then once it gets to the House, it might be pointless. So, question mark.
Yeah, and that's what it remains. It's almost like they had like 8 years to figure out how to write a bill to replace this thing they've been rallying against for 8 years or
so
7 years.
This is clearly newspapers. Actual reporters are going to do a great job today trying to explain all this stuff, but just checking in periodically isn't really going to make much sense.
Yeah.
You're going to think that, oh, it's done, it's been voted down, For example, John McCain. John McCain got a lot of flack from the left on Monday saying, hey, I want everyone to vote for this. We should open for debate and we should get back to normal rules. And then later in that day, he voted for a bill he said he wouldn't vote for. But by that point, it already had received enough nays to not progress. So it was more a symbolic vote, which is confusing.
Right. And the whole thing is, it's supposed to be confusing. Don't worry. If you're confused, that's how it's designed. And the senators are confused. A lot of the senators, they're not that bright. A lot of them, they don't really get it. That's why when they're like, oh, the party line, like that's why most people are just voting yes or no with their party, because it makes it a lot easier.
When you know something's not going to pass, it's a lot easier to legislate. It's a lot easier to vote down Obamacare for six consecutive years, because right. It went through in 10, rather than actually do something else. So this is a bipartisan podcast. This is a bipartisan issue.
Yeah.
The Punjabi prison is confusing to everyone.
Yeah, I still don't know the rules of that, and I refuse to watch it. The best, I think, feud we've had brewing that's the closest thing to... One of the closer things to wrestling we've had this week is the president's continued feud with his own attorney general that he appointed, who is one of his longest and strongest supporters, Jeff Sessions, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, in case you thought he wasn't from the South. He's tweeted that he's beleaguered, he's weak. Trump has tweeted this, wondering why Sessions and the DOJ has not investigated Hillary, her emails, etc. He's still very upset that Sessions... recuse himself, and the reporting is saying that they're trying to get Sessions to quit instead of firing him, which they know will be a political and legal issue for them. But Sessions, he's like, no, I got a lot of work to do. There's still black people who can vote. Like, I have things to do here, and you can't fire me.
Yeah. So once again, the left is very like kind of please fire him, but also like don't end this because this is pretty fun.
Yeah, like we want resolution to this feud, but
at the same time,
you want to keep going. You got a couple more pay-per-views out of this.
But if anybody else replaces him, like Ted Cruz's name has been floated as replacing.
That's hilarious.
I'm not joking. He's been floated as replacing Jeff Sessions. That might be good if you don't believe in the DARE program, or you don't believe in mandatory minimum sentences, or you don't believe in really strict enforcement of immigration rules. So,
yeah.
If you're on the left or if you're on the right, you really don't know how you want this to play out. If you're a Trump loyalist, wouldn't that weaken Trump? Do you want Trump to stay a Republican? Is this the first thing that make Trump maybe a third party candidate?
A sitting president is not going to be a third party candidate.
Okay.
No one is. That's not a thing that's happening.
You can
book it. When we have Trump as third president, play this podcast. The other thing is he's the president has apparently been kind of pondering if he could do a recess appointment because Grassley on Judiciary says that they will not be confirming another AG in the same year because that's ridiculous. So he might do a recess appointment. But they also said in that same report that, you know, Trump just kind of says hypotheticals and changes his mind hour to hour. So it's tough to kind of gauge what he's really thinking.
From the start of this presidency, from the start of the campaign, there's been a lot of talk of Trump likes to fire people. He doesn't actually fire people. He forces them to quit, or he gets rid of them in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
And that's happened consistently. But even though people don't necessarily get fired, there's still a spotlight on them that is negative that makes their job a little bit more difficult.
Yeah, I've never had the president tweet that I'm beleaguered, okay? That doesn't seem like it would be great.
So, like, Rance Priebus has probably been the most consistently, like, out the door guy.
Mm-hmm.
Today, while we're recording this, his new communications dude is saying, hey, I don't like that dude. That can't be good for the job. Once he's gone, will probably feel relieved. If you've seen Sean Spicer's photos in the last few days, it looks like a very happy man.
Yeah, because we didn't talk about that. One of the people who was not fired but quit was Sean Spicer, who left as White House communications director over objections, allegedly, to them bringing in Anthony Scaramucci, who is now our favorite mouthpiece, our favorite advocate in the Trump administration.
I love this so much. I sent Chris this about an hour ago. This is from an hour ago on CNN's New Day, which is a tribute show to New Day.
Or not, that will be up to the president. But he's the chief of staff. He's responsible for understanding and uncovering and helping me do that inside the White House, which is why I put that tweet out last night. When the journalists who actually know who the leakers are, like Ryan Lizard. They know the leakers. Jonathan Swain at Axios. These guys know who the leakers are. I respect them for not telling me because I understand and respect journalistic integrity. However, when I put out a tweet and I put Reince's name in the tweet, they're all making the assumption that it's him because journalists know who the leakers are. So if Reince wants to explain that he's not a leaker, let him do that. But let me tell you something about myself. I am a straight shooter, and I'll go right to the heart of the matter. Okay, so I'm done talking. You can ask me questions, but be nice on this segment, Chris, because this is a very serious matter of interest to all of America.
Yeah.
That's 1 minute of a 5-minute answer that was given pretty much without prompt.
Yeah.
No, in that same promo, he also mentioned he was going to visit his mother in New York. This guy
you're
is
allowed to do that because you have Italian heritage.
This guy, I know. This is a little, I hate my heritage. It's heritage, not hate. Don't worry. This is Lil Enzo to Big Cass, and I realize his name is Enzo. He is Lil Enzo to Trump's Big Cass. I didn't think Trump could. I thought Trump would always be the best promo. He would always be the best on the stick. Nope. Yeah. This guy is so good.
I like your initial comparison to CM Punk taking on Heyman when Punk was already the best promo in the business, and then he got the other best promo in the business. So, I mean, you get two. It's a double-barrel attack here.
Now that I'm, but listening to him in the New York stuff, it's like, no, this is clearly still, yeah. Enzo. This is clearly
yeah, no.
Enzo. Also,
Rens Priebus, there's one word for you. I'm going to spell it out. S-A-W-F-T.
Also, this is not Heyman Punk because Heyman stuck around, not Punk.
Right.
So in this scenario, Trump is clearly Big Cass. Also, Big Cass, Trump supporter.
He's getting the... That apparently was like...
This is joke. Enzo. This is going to play out exactly like Enzo and Big Cass.
I don't want Anthony... I don't want the Mooch to take a big boot to the face.
And even the Big Show can't save him.
I know. No, Scaramucci, my favorite thing is from his first... the day he got announced, he hopped up, got on the stick, and here's what he had to say.
But here's what I tell you about the president. He's the most competitive person I've ever met. Okay, I've seen this guy throw a dead spiral through a tire. I've seen him at Madison Square Garden with a top coat on. He's standing in the key, and he's hitting foul shots and swishing them. Okay, he sinks 3-foot putts. I don't see this guy as a guy that's ever under siege. This is a very, very competitive person. Obviously, there's a lot of incoming that comes into the White House, but the president's a winner. Okay, and what we're going to do is we're going to do a lot of winning.
And, you know, that's honestly, is he describing President Trump or is he describing Mr. Perfect's intro vignettes?
Could you give in a quick 20-second explainer about Mr. Perfect?
So Mr. Perfect, Kurt Hennig, when he was coming to the WWE or WWF at that time, they did these vignettes where he was perfect. He could throw a spiral pass and catch it in the end zone, throw it to himself. He could hit some dingers with Wade Boggs. He could sink a 3-foot putt. He could flip his pencil and catch it. He spit his gum. Whatever he needed to do, he was perfect at it. And those are the things that Mooch was describing.
In addition to make it even a better comparison, in the vignettes they used real athletes. You mentioned Wade Boggs. I want to say Boomer Esiason was one of the guys playing
that
catch with
right.
him. The fact that Scaramucci mentioned that he was sinking free throws at Madison Square Garden.
You seem bemused by this. Like, if he had front row, if he had, like, the good seats, if he had the spike seats, you don't think Trump...
I'm not disagreeing. Okay. I'm not disagreeing.
I don't think it actually happened.
The thing that makes it weird is, number one, seeking free throws is not that difficult.
If you're Shaq, it is.
Number two... You mean WrestleMania 32 guest check?
Yeah, not okay. 33 because he bailed. Cause they want to pay him.
It's not that hard to sink free throws with a trench coat on. Why are you bragging that a man is afraid to take off his trench coat? Like he did it. He refused to take off his trench coat at WrestleMania's. All of them,
yeah.
By the way.
Have you seen him in a trench coat?
I'm just saying.
It hides his horrible body.
I just think that the things that make that Scaramucci was saying that makes him great to me are the things that make him very weak.
Yeah.
It's not like he was like, you know what? He had a parka on and he was sinking threes and shaking kids' hands and like giving out $50 bills. Like, to me, that's more impressive.
Yeah, DiBiase shit.
Yeah. This is not that. Okay. This is like really pedestrian. Like, yeah, any dad could do this.
Like, 3-foot putts is not. Like,
that's not
it's
that
been a
difficult.
While since I've been on a golf course, but that's not
that's
like,
literally the premise of mini golf.
Listen, he's really good at mini golf. The club looks big in his hands. Yeah, it's been a busy week. Trump also spoke to the Boy Scouts, which people were so upset about. he at the beginning opened up and said,
"Tonight, we put aside all of the policy fights in Washington, D.C. you've been hearing about with the fake news and all of that. We're going to put that aside. And instead, we're going to talk about success, about how all of you amazing young scouts can achieve your dreams, what to think of, what I've been thinking about. You want to achieve your dreams?" I said, "Who the hell wants to speak about politics when I'm in front of the Boy Scouts, right?"
So then he proceeded to talk about politics to 45,000 Boy Scouts, which, by the way, like, it, when you get the crowd shots of this, like, if you did it in black and white, we're looking at Hitler Youth, right? Like, I don't like seeing 45,000 dead-eyed children of the corn in uniform. You're gonna come out against this?
I'm trying to play devil's advocate. I'm not anti-Boy Scouts, and I'm not anti-speaking to the Boy Scouts. I'm definitely against anti-railing in the Boy Scouts around anything political. And I think that's the consensus.
All right, well, listen, they had an Iraqi sympathizer in Sergeant Slaughter, and they turned all those Boy Scouts turned out fine. Some of them are in the administration.
Did you find any audio from that Sergeant Slaughter appearance?
No, I think the picture says 1,000 words, and I just needed a connection.
We're way
to WWE.
This is the most in the weeds, horrible referenced show we've ever done. But really
no,
quick,
they're all pretty bad.
Really quick, you tweeted out an image. A photograph.
A pretty picture.
Of Sergeant Slaughter.
Which listeners of the show will know from, if not wrestling, then from G.I. Joe.
Exactly. He was the biggest crossover star next to Hulk Hogan. He had his own G.I. Joe line. That's important. He was an Iraqi sympathizer in 1990 during the first Iraq War.
Because they needed a heel to go up against Hogan when the Warrior stuff didn't work out.
That,
and they turned their beloved all-American sergeant into an Iraqi sympathizer.
To get Hulk Hogan over.
Hulk always goes over, brother.
That was at WrestleMania 7. That was the feud of WrestleMania 7 in Los Angeles. That was the WrestleMania where they moved it from the L.A. Coliseum, which is massive, to the L.A. Sports Arena, which is not massive. It sold out.
Yeah.
Willie Nelson sang the national anthem. Macaulay Culkin was there. And Marla Maples was there, Donald Trump's then new wife.
Right. But as wife or as mistress? Because she was mistress.
At that point, I think they were, him and Ivana were divorced.
Did you pause before saying Ivana so you didn't fuck it up?
Yes.
Okay, cool. I do that too. I think probably one of the bigger issues on, which I think we're just at the beginning of it. I don't think it's going to be a huge issue for now. I think it's going to be an issue in the election, is Trump's decision to ban transgender individuals from the military by tweet fiat yesterday.
Yes, we are talking about transgendered individuals. Yes, we were talking about the military. But there's something else we have to mention.
From Politico, suggesting that Trump's decision to do this kind of out of nowhere yesterday, a congressional fight over sex reassignment surgery threatened funding for Trump's border wall. So it's time to break the walls down.
We are going to build a great border wall, you know, to stop illegal immigration. Yeah.
Your favorite segment, anytime the border wall comes up. But yeah, no, the crazy people who are kind of appealing to emotion or appealing to heart when they're saying, I mean, or logic, showing these transgender veterans who have served, who are coming out against this. That's like a bank shot that it happens to be a good thing that for conservatives, this could prove to be their 2004 gay marriage bans, that it's going to be a tough issue for Democrats in swing states to come out in favor of this, even though it's just obviously the right thing. But it's accidentally a good issue for them, but it was just because the border wall was threatened.
Nothing is that confusing. Yeah. Everything happens for a reason in both wrestling and presidential politics.
Yeah.
It's not that complicated.
Yeah. And this did happen 12 hours after the man who would break down the walls of Jericho, Chris Jericho, returned to the WWE after a surprisingly short absence. I guess just as long as Fozzy had tour dates.
Pretty much.
I thought he would be gone in like
a year.
Till Rumble.
That's almost a year.
Almost a year.
Yeah.
6 months. So Chris Jericho returned on Tuesday to SmackDown. This is now, in case you were playing along at home, this is now the time when we're going to talk about wrestling. So I think we covered everything in politics. And We covered it. We're done. So Chris Jericho's back on SmackDown, kind of recovering from Battleground pay-per-view, one of the WWE's worst pay-per-views, probably of all time. It started with one good match and got progressively worse, ending in what Brandon mentioned earlier with no context, the Punjabi prison match, which is like at two cages, and they're made of bamboo, kind of, and then a 7-foot Indian man showed up. It was very confusing. Especially if you didn't watch wrestling in the mid-2000s when the great Khali, who can barely walk, his mobility is not getting any better.
No.
He basically looks like Andre the Giant. I think he has the same disorder, the giantism that
Oh, makes, he does.
Yeah.
So the reason why this exists, the reason why Jinder Mahal is the current WWE champion is because there are 1.2 or 1.3?
I was 1.2 yesterday. It's 1.3 today.
Okay, 1.3 billion Indians.
Yes,
in the world. He is from Calgary / India.
Yes.
So that's why they did this. It totally makes sense. My only statement is, what do you think is going to happen when Vince finds out there are 1.57 billion Muslims in the world?
Push Mustafa Ali. God damn it, kid's amazing on 205 Live. No one's watching it, but the kid's a lot of funny. So.
Yeah, it was a... I feel bad for everyone involved. I feel bad for the city of Philadelphia, where Battleground was held. I feel bad for the participants in this match.
Yeah, everybody. The Kevin Owens and AJ Styles match, which beforehand was, well, at least we got a match between two of the best wrestlers. How could they possibly fuck that up? Oh, they fucked it up. There was some sort of botched or botchy finish. It doesn't look like it was supposed to go that way, which is why on Tuesday, Jericho's back for a triple threat for the title, which put the belt back on AJ. It looks... like that was their original plan for Sunday. That match was excellent. The triple throw on SmackDown.
So the plan for Sunday was for AJ to retain or for Jericho to come out?
AJ to retain. I think the Jericho thing is kind of hot-shotted. Because so, I think AJ was supposed to, his shoulder, the ref was supposed to notice his shoulder was up, and that's why AJ didn't kick out.
Oh, so we should mention this every time. Wrestling is predetermined, but the refs don't know at this point.
They
don't know.
They do, but they've been also instructed to call it. They're in a really bad position.
Yes.
It's like what Vince McMahon and Trump, how they treat their employees. They're like, here's what you need to do, but if you do this other thing, you're fired.
Yeah.
And referees know the finish, yet they have to call it like a real thing. So if this guy's not supposed to win and the other guy's shoulders are down and he counts to three, that's it. And
okay,
then they
so
deal with it later.
Who's going to get in trouble for this?
The ref's on vacation, allegedly, till like Labor Day.
Okay, so we already know.
Yeah, so the ref got in trouble.
Okay.
But anyway, historically bad pay-per-view. Excellent tag match with the New Day and the Usos. That was a lot of fun.
Speaking of the New Day, you wrote a great piece about the New Day, which is a wonderful time to reshare. He wrote it for Vice, and it's about the New Day and black excellence. And
it's called New Day and Being Black in WWE. It's from... about a year ago in Vice Sports, which rest in peace, Vice Sports. Yeah, but it's still on the internet. You can check it out because the New Day is evergreen content because they're evergreen.
Watch that match and then read the article or back. Just do it together. You'll enjoy both more.
Yes. Anything. So in wrestling,
I didn't hate the women's match. I didn't hate the women's match.
Not gonna watch it. Lana's in it. Tamina's in it. It's just real bad. But Total Divas will be good. Total Bellas coming back September 6th. And then Total Divas to follow with new cast members, Carmella, Alexa, and Nia Jax, which I'm very excited for.
Sure.
You don't watch?
No, I watch all of it.
Okay, I was going to say. Then you should be excited.
I'm an idiot. I understand politics. You got to watch Divas. Oh, by the way.
Oh, yeah, I did that.
Yeah, we turned on the Alexa Amazon thing because Alexa Bliss is on Total Divas.
So you have to... I like technology that makes you whisper and be paranoid in your own house. Thanks a lot, Amazon, Washington Post, Jeff Bezos.
So, yeah, it's pointless to go further in depth about anything in terms of wrestling or politics today.
We're on the road to SummerSlam.
It's going to be fine.
Yeah, everything's going to be fine. That's our hot take here.
By the time SummerSlam happens, which is August 20th, we will probably be in the exact same place we are with healthcare as of today. Maybe it could be... a thing.
We don't know. I'm going to use this opportunity to plug one other thing and something that's coming up this weekend as we are in this doldrums of politics and wrestling is UFC 214, Cormier Jones 2 finally happening.
Didn't you write a different Vice piece about this fight?
I did. I wrote a thing about Daniel Cormier and John Jones, the UFC's own WWE feud, comparing it to the legendary feud between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. And that's been, that one has continued to be more so even than McGregor Mayweather, the real WWE feud in the UFC.
Cormier called out Lesnar, right? Or is Jones. It Jones called out Lesnar yesterday?
Yeah, he kind of he wants a fight. He said he'd love to fight Lesnar. Lesnar was like probably said bring it on or something. But this, I mean, you can't say nothing's gonna happen because Mayweather McGregor is actually happening. But there's about a 100-pound like a 60-70-pound difference between Jones is a light heavyweight.
Hold on. But isn't that so? Jones in theory would just gain a bunch of weight or be okay with signing off, because once you get to the heavyweight division, you could be as heavy as you want. I thought.
Yes.
Okay,
but he has to get up to that, which is like 250, 260 or something.
Is it really that heavy? Isn't it just a waiver thing? I mean, understand going lower. I understand that
right,
part.
Right.
Hence McGregor holding two belts at the same time.
Yeah.
But
you go up and down in weight class. I mean, that was yeah.
But if
McGregor fought, I think, welter for Diaz.
Yeah.
So.
But the whole idea of this is a one-off freak of nature fight.
Right. I mean, no, listen, if they want this to happen, they'll pretend it's UFC 1 and just put two guys out there.
Exactly.
And they'll do it.
So the reason why I'm asking this is because is the only thing holding it back the weight?
And the fact that, I mean, I brought up the other day the rumors that Lesnar's actually in the testing pool. I mean, we'll see what happens when he drops the belt on SummerSlam if he's back in the USADA testing pool, if he actually is going to go back to UFC.
So that's something to pay attention to.
Yes.
That makes SummerSlam actually interesting.
Yes.
Okay, so here's the interview I did with Julie Azari. We don't talk about wrestling at all, but please, 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 if you only listen to the show for wrestling, which I don't know why you would, but that's nice of you. Thank you very much. Think about Trump as Vince McMahon. Like in our book, and this will make a lot more sense, and it's a lot more fun, and it's a lot more interesting. I'm really appreciative of anyone that's willing to talk to us, especially that someone that doesn't know about wrestling. We both have college degrees, and if 2017 proves anything, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter what you think!
So we're recording this on Wednesday, July 26th at 2 p.m., so keep in mind that if you're listening to this, things might have changed dramatically. But you wrote this piece that I thought was really great for 538, and it went up yesterday, Why Russia Revelations Never Seem to Change Anything. And it pretty much says that there's a cycle of scandal. It comes to revelations, then outrage, then concern, and then the hearing, and then that's about it. But stuff actually might be going on in the background that the general public just doesn't know about or doesn't care about. Do you see anything that's happened this week with Jared or maybe Paul Manafort that might possibly change things in the future?
So I think it's difficult to tell. A couple of things. Let me actually talk a little bit about the background on this piece. So I started writing this piece about a week and a half ago. I had this idea, and the editor I was working with thought, you know, that makes some sense. And so I kind of delved into all the research that I cite in that piece about partisanship and about the way the media works. And then I got on something else. And then I felt like that cycle actually repeated itself on Friday. When I went to bed on Thursday night, everyone was talking about whether Trump could pardon himself and his latest tweet. And I thought, okay, this is what we're talking about now. And by the time it was, you know, lunchtime, we were all talking about Sean Spicer. And, you know, Anthony Scaramucci, whose name is way more fun to say than anything that had happened in the previous week. So I felt like as I was writing this piece that it actually happened a couple times where we went through the cycle. When I started writing it, the Donald Trump Jr.'s emails were the main story. And by the time I was doing copy edits and working with the copy editor, we had gone through several cycles. At the same time, I do think there is a little bit of accumulation over time of all this stuff where, you know, it kind of drops off the media. One particular story will drop off media attention, but it started to become one continuous story. So Nate Silver had a piece today on 538. He's the editor-in-chief of 538, in which he kind of disagrees with me. And it's also a very interesting piece, and one thing that he noted is that it's really Russia started to dominate the news cycle. And I think also in Congress, we're seeing a couple of things. So one is a kind of ongoing series of investigations and testimonies going on. And and also outside of Congress, Robert Mueller continues to do his thing, a special counsel. And we don't always see the day-to-day with that, but I think that those things, all this evidence that may or may not be accumulating, or all these pieces of evidence that lead up to something, you know, that's all happening behind the scenes. That's all being taken into account. The other thing that I think we're seeing this morning, so this morning's big story is Trump's tweets about transgender individuals in the military. Mm-hmm. And one of the striking things about that story is we're seeing some very conservative Republicans publicly disagree. So I do think one of the things we're starting to see is that this has always been like kind of an awkward relationship between Trump and the Republican Party, and we're starting to see some of those cracks reemerge. So those are the two things I think are most relevant. But this is the first time I've written a story about a phenomenon and felt like that phenomenon has sort of like happened during the course of my thinking and editing.
Absolutely. This relates back to the piece that you wrote in May, Even the Biggest Scandals Can't Kill Party Loyalty. This is from today's piece, what I'm going to say is from yesterday's piece, but it relates back to that May piece, which is scandals are just likely to reinforce partisan views rather than transcend them. So does any of this matter? I know that you said today with the transgender announcement that you are seeing some blowback from Republicans, but they're still sticking with Donald.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that has kind of been the story of this past year or so is the incredible weight of partisanship. And I think that also weighs on some other, like, major political forces in American politics. So one of, you know, as you said, I wrote about this back in May with a couple of other people at 538 with Perry Bacon and Harry Enten. And I did the data for that piece and kind of had the original idea about kind of the hypothesis that the more consistent party members would be the ones who stuck with presidents through scandals, and the ones that broke away would be the ones that were always a little bit less consistent in their party loyalty. And that's probably the best that any idea I've had has worked out as far as the data in my entire career. So that was my role with that piece, and that just, I mean, kind of shows that this isn't new either, but I think the strength of it is a little new. The other thing that I want to emphasize in this piece that I think is important is that scandal also has these interesting effects on how people perceive the political system in general. So there's a partisan component to that, right? People, media outlets in particular, follow their own partisan leanings when it comes to how they cover scandals. That's been found. And also, obviously, people kind of read, you know, see what they see through a partisan lens. But they also see it in terms of, well, what does this tell me about how much I can trust government or politicians in general? Mm-hmm. And most studies, not surprisingly, have found that it doesn't do anything for your perception of government, right? It doesn't help you trust government if you're constantly reading about scandal. But also that effect can dampen over time, where then you just become skeptical and cynical of everything. And I think the other important point there is trust in American institutions has been low. A year ago, we were talking about how we had two very unpopular candidates for president relative to candidates in the past. We had a lot of distrust in political parties. So I think it's hard for a scandal to kind of break through that or to shatter trust that doesn't exist. And that contributes to stasis, where it kind of contributes to people's sense that, well, you know, government is up to no good. You can't trust politicians. You can't trust parties. You can't trust people in Washington. If you already believed that, then finding out about a scandal isn't really going to change your views or your behavior.
But you do mention that in your other piece that the centrists are, those are the people that are going to leave the party, leave the scandal first, maybe throw their own person overboard first, which brings me to a question. Do you think that we are getting, in a weird way, to a three-party system, Democrats, Republicans, and Trumpians? Mm-hmm. It seems like that if Donald Trump throws Jeff Sessions overboard, he's kind of a man without a party at that point, isn't he?
So that's an interesting question. I've seen people throw that hypothesis out there, and it's really hard to figure out where this all maps on. So here's my best attempt to try and guess at that. There's a couple things that I think we can say with some confidence. One of them is that there are fewer moderate legislators by using the measure that we used in the piece, which is basically we look at how somebody votes over time. There are fewer moderate or inconsistent, frequent party defectors in Congress. That's a development of the last, 20 years or so, really. And so we know that. So there's fewer of these folks to begin with. The other thing is that, well, Trump seems to kind of cut across certain values in the party and split the party. And so I know that there are some people who kind of have this view that Trump is a whole separate party, and like maybe we'll find out that's true. But I think one of the things we kind of keep finding is that being someone who's from outside Washington and not having a lot of existing relationships has forced Trump to, I think, be responsive to a Republican Party, the most organized base, which is the evangelical and Christian right. It's made him, I think, much more beholden to that base than he would otherwise be, which is kind of what we're seeing today. And so in that sense, I think that, that's that core of the party might continue to be loyal to him because he's been a pretty faithful, no pun intended, server of their agenda, if that makes any sense. So I don't really know. That part, I think, is sort of speculative. But for me, it seems very clear that while Trump was elected, I think, in large part to be outside of some of those party power structures, that he's more beholden to it than, someone like Jeb Bush or John Kasich or Marco Rubio would have been, because he doesn't have a lot of relationships or expertise as far as how the Washington game is played.
Your first piece for 538, January 11th, 2016. There's one thing worse than for the GOP than a Trump nomination, which is Trump as a third party candidate. I think what's going on today, a John Kasich, Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders 2020 run does not seem impossible after what's going on today. And yes, he is appealing to evangelicals, but yes, he's also riling up some people in his own party that are now left trying to frame a narrative that they didn't know was coming from the transgendered ban. He doesn't necessarily need the same type of people that helped get him elected.
So, that's a good question, too. I think most presidents need the people who helped them get elected, right? They need to keep most of those people. Typically, in fact, until this is like way a digression, but this is what happens when you call me. Typically, the presidents tended in their first term to either build their coalition or lose. So Obama was one of the first and only presidents to lose, to win his reelection by less than his first election and still win. So I think we've got some weird stuff going on in American politics right now as far as presidents' ability to keep coalitions together. It's funny with that piece, so I don't think I've ever done an interview where someone has so thoroughly read everything that I have written and remembers it surely better than I do. But one of the things with that piece that I was thinking about was the real nightmare scenario for Republicans is probably a Trump presidency, because I admit that based on his qualifications, I didn't think he was going to do a very good job. And it's way worse. You can totally get over a bad candidate, but a bad presidency will follow your party's reputation around for a long time. And that's true of Republicans and Democrats alike. But so going back to the question you asked me about a possible Sanders, Kasich, Trump 2020 three-way race, I think that one of the fundamental things in such a race would be, and this would apply equally to Trump and to Sanders, is that you make these, when politicians make these kinds of appeals about being outside of politics, that gets people really excited and kind of jazzes people up on their populist values and what they want to see reflected. But then once they're in office, that becomes much harder to translate into governing, because really governing is all about you're making deals that may not be pretty. You may have to compromise with people that your supporters don't like. You have to make choices and priorities. You have to think about stability a little bit, which I think both Sanders and Trump, their supporters were kind of jazzed with the idea of blowing everything up. And there is something to be said, regardless of your ideology, for stability in the economy. If you look at Wall Street or whatever, Wall Street likes stability. They don't like surprises. So I think, I guess I'm revealing myself as a political scientist to be pretty skeptical of those kinds of claims from the right or the left or from the center.
You're in Wisconsin, is that correct?
Yes.
How is today's news playing out? Because I'm in D.C. My wife is in D.C. My co-host is in D.C. I work literally two blocks from the White House. I have no idea. And I'm from Chicago. And when I go back, it's not that different than in D.C. But I want to know how this is playing in Wisconsin.
Well, so I'm in Wisconsin, but let's be clear about where I am. I'm in Milwaukee on a university campus, and I live in a neighborhood where with a lot of near a lot of other university faculty. So I'm not going to be giving you like here's what's going on in kind of deep rural Wisconsin. Here in Milwaukee, which is a Democratic city, one thing that I got on Twitter this morning from my husband, who follows a lot of sports Twitter, he said people in the sports world in Milwaukee who do not write about politics or social issues were denouncing the transgender ban on Twitter. Other than that, also, I'm a professor and it's summer, so I'm like in my office alone. I haven't seen anybody. But yeah, you know, I don't know how it's playing. I'm really interested in that question. There was a quote from someone in the administration about, you know, blue-collar workers in the Rust Belt, and this, you know, how are they going to react when someone like Debbie Stabenow, and the senator from Michigan, has to make this a central issue? And you know, I don't really know. I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer to that.
When you decided to make this your career, did any part of you think that I should watch The Apprentice, I should follow professional wrestling, I should know more of these pop culture things? Or did you gravitate towards this because it was the exact opposite of pop culture?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, I'm not a big pop culture person. I've never seen The Apprentice. When I decided to make this my career, it was the mid-2000s, and what I was really interested in was the way that politicians use different ideas to justify what they're doing, and I was really interested in how a lot of the problems I thought in the world, like I thought that hunger was because we didn't have enough food, right? I grew up thinking that. Mm-hmm. And then you learn, no, this is a political problem. And then I got really interested in ideology. So that was how I ended up making this my career, and then writing things on the internet kind of happened accidentally, so there was like no thought process at all behind that. I never thought I should be watching those things, which in retrospect was maybe a little short-sighted, because what I was interested in really is in values and how those values are communicated.
It's interesting because I have a political science degree, and I was consistently chastised when I would bring up things like, hey, Jay-Z signing this full-page ad in the New York Times against or for this thing is a big deal to people that have PhDs. You have a PhD. You have a master's degree in this stuff.
I have a PhD also.
Okay, there you go. Nice humble brag. So you have a PhD in this stuff.
It's not a humble brag. That's just reality.
I apologize. You have a PhD in this stuff. So if a student brings to you something from outside of the pop culture, from the pop culture world, how do you approach that? Will you take the time to maybe invest some more thought into it? Or do you think that this is just a fleeting moment, never to be repeated again?
No, so I haven't, you know, that actually has not really happened to me. My students often, when they bring up pop culture, they bring up pop culture that's expressly political. So House of Cards or West Wing, which at this point is about as old as my students. But, you know, I will say it was one of my close friends, another presidential scholar, Lily Gorin, has really convinced me to pay attention to the politics of pop culture. And she's written a book about Mad Men, and, you know, it's really brought a lot of scholarly rigor to this. And I've had her come to my class, and I've had my students read about the West Wing. So I'm very encouraging of my students to meet politics from where they are. But I also try to be humble about, you know, where my limitations in terms of understanding pop culture. It's not possible for everyone to do everything.
Oh, of course.
So, you know, that's my own personal limit. But yeah, I think it's important, and I think that power and like how we think about how society works and who's deserving of what, all of that is all through pop culture for sure.
You have one of the most interesting author bios on these sites. So if you read Slate, if you read 530, if you read a lot of these things, there's always a little bio at the end for someone that's writing a piece like yours. And yours mentions that your research includes political rhetoric. And that's what stuck out to me. Is that like an official thing? Could someone get like a PhD in political rhetoric? What does that exactly mean?
So you can. You can get a PhD in communication.
Okay.
And focus on political communication and rhetoric. My PhD is in political science.
Yes.
Actually, you know, rhetoric was another thing that I kind of fell into. There weren't a lot of people doing communication when I went to grad school, but I wrote my dissertation, which later became a book, on how presidents interpret elections and claim mandates. And I think the way I study rhetoric is kind of like, here's a whole bunch of data that we have about how someone really powerful, in this case the president, talks about an idea. So to me, that's how I think about it. Other people think of rhetoric in different in different ways and study it maybe through like a more literary lens, which would be something the communication folks would do. But I think of it as like, what does this tell us about what kinds of values there were in politics, or what we were anxious about at any given time, which is kind of where I landed with the mandate rhetoric. We typically think presidents claim mandates when they've won a big election, and that's not at all the reality. We all become very focused on mandates and what elections mean just at times when politics seems illegitimate and divided, right? It's used to kind of to bolster the legitimacy of a powerful presidency. So that's my story and background with political rhetoric. One day in grad school, I just started reading speeches and looking for whether or not presidents claimed mandates, and then that became my dissertation.
This has to be a very weird time for you, because I can't think of a time where 538 in your profession and what you do is more valued, but at the exact same time, more hated from other people.
Yeah, I don't know if you're talking about the media or academia there.
Sure, we can go with both, actually.
Both, yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, I really enjoy doing the journalism stuff and writing for 538 and things like that. I think that the media, you know, but the thing is with that stuff, like, I'm not really embedded in that power structure. Whereas as an academic, you know, I've been at Marquette for 10 years. I'm director of our grad program. Like, it's really, you know, I kind of know what higher ed is facing and about, you know, what the funding is and the enrollment and all that kind of stuff. And that, I think, you know, it's not trivial that people, and particular evidence shows people on one side of the political spectrum have kind of turned on academia. I don't know who's entirely to blame for that, but I think that, you know, that's really a problem, because at the end of the day, I think most people in academia think that their job is to teach and to try to do research and find the truth. And it is true that you overwhelmingly get a lot of people in academia who are liberal, but for many of them, that's not, like, that's pretty separate from what they do. And the idea that there's a whole, you know, set of structures in American politics and colleges and universities that somehow is setting out to do one thing when really it's doing another and it's contributing to mistrust in our society, I think is really a problem. And I think that the media is obviously a really important part of democracy too, and I feel very strongly about that. But I have to admit the whole academia angle is much more personal.
If you have a new student, what do you tell an undergrad whose parent just doesn't like what you do or doesn't believe that their child is spending their time wisely? Or does that even come up? Because if they're already at Marquette, they clearly care about their education.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, like, I haven't had that come up very much. You know, parents, we hear a lot about helicopter parents. I've mostly not interacted with parents. My students are adults. Mm-hmm. You know, I think people are concerned about their kids majoring in something that will help them get a job. We spend a lot of time both trying to communicate about what our former students do and trying to help our students find their way. And people with political science degrees, as you know, find their way in all sorts of potentially unpredictable but very interesting paths. I have not really encountered the politics thing, and I have a number of undergraduate students that I have been close with over the years, all across the political spectrum. I don't know if their parents have ever, been part of that. What I try to give them is a language of how to analyze things. And if they use that for politics, that's great. If they use that for other things, that's also fine. But I think people really appreciate having a shared language to make sense of the world and not just see the things that develop as like, oh, well, there's one thing after another, but as things that may seem not to be connected that actually are connected. And that gives you, I think when people study that together and have those realizations together, that actually creates some deep bonds across political views of having this shared way of understanding and analyzing the world and a shared language to disagree about it.